afternoon. I'm Loreto Rojas.
And I'm Cal Winslow.
We are back with Talking About California, this time with a series observing Hispanic Heritage Month.
And today we'll focus on the police and the and police reform and the implications of these issues and this new movement of Black Lives Matter for the Latino community.
Our guest today is Brooklyn College professor Alex Vitale. Professor Vitale is an author and professor of sociology. He is also the coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College.
And his writings can be found in the New York Times, The Nation, The Appeal, USA Today, Vice News, and other media outlets.
He is a leading, if not the leading, voice for police reform. His award-winning 2017 book, The End of Policing, should be at the top of everyone's reading list. Verso temporarily made the ebook copy of The End of Policing available for free, and it had been downloaded 200,000 times by June 2020.
So, Alex, it's really great to have you here.
Thanks, Cal. Thanks, Loreto.
Well, let's just jump right in with Black Lives Matter and your book. We talked to you last in 2014, I think it was, in the aftermath of Ferguson and the Michael Brown killing. Let's start off. Where are we now?
Well, we are in a different position. After the Michael Brown killing, after the police killing of Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, so many others, the mood in the country was like, well, we need to fix policing. And the feeling was we were going to do this in a couple of ways. One is there was a voice from the street calling, for jailing killer cops and accountability in that sense, and that this was going to somehow feed back into better policing. And the other was the kind of technocratic procedural justice response that said, well, we can fix policing by making them more professional, having them follow proper procedures, weeding out the bad apples, giving them implicit bias training. And the moment we're in now is very different. Mostly those approaches are in decline. And what we see instead is a robust demand to reduce the scope and power of policing. There's a deep skepticism about the ability to reform policing, especially given this incredibly broad mission that they've been given. And so while the police abuse continues and the police remain unreformed, the movement has gone through major changes, both local groups, people organizing in the streets, but also big national organizations. Have moved, no one's holding up a sign anymore saying more money for body cameras, more money for implicit bias training, more community policing. Those ideas are gone, and we need to get about the business of getting them out of schools, out of the mental health business, out of the drug business, out of the sex work business, et cetera.
Yes, this has been quite finally bringing to the surface the deepest problem here, right? As you were just saying, Alex, at the beginning, we were all demanding to have more accountability, but it seems that the issue that the police is dealing with are very engraved in our way of life and society. Can you please refer to that?
So, accountability is limited by the fact that our elected leaders have sent the police on a mission, and the police are carrying that mission out. And so why would the political leaders want to hold them accountable for doing what they've been assigned to do? So instead, they sometimes will throw one or two officers under a bus for their, slightly overstepping the line, or really more for getting caught with their hand in the cookie jar, so to speak, for getting caught on tape doing what they've been told to do, essentially. So the challenge in trying to move forward with this is exactly what you said, that for 40, 50 years now, we've been told the solution to every problem is the police. trash on the streets, loose dogs, failed schools, untreated mental health and substance abuse problems, mass homelessness. Everything is something for the police to manage. And we haven't been given any other options, especially in poor and non-white communities. This is it. It's the police or nothing. So we have a tremendous amount of work to do on the ground to work with communities to try to lay out what a non-police approach would look like, and also just building up the confidence that we can begin to ask for those things rather than just have this false choice of police or nothing.
You mentioned there were different organizations and movements. Would you venture to just give us an idea of what kind of movements they are? And I don't know if you want to go there, but anything about Seattle or Portland?
Well, what we've seen is that there's been this growth in the number of very local campaigns across the country. And I spent the last 3 years before COVID, crisscrossing the country. I was on a plane every other week visiting cities where these campaigns were underway. These were efforts to get police out of the schools or to shut down a jail and provide certain kinds of community services instead, to stop the building of a new youth lockup facility of some kind, right? So these things were all percolating somewhat under the radar because they were very local struggles. Some were having some success, some were growing, but no one really thought they were going to be like the center of national news attention every day for weeks, or, a primary consideration in the presidential campaign. I don't think people thought that that movement was at that place. And what we've also seen is this growing number of national groups and regional groups moving from thinking they can fix policing with implicit bias training and body cameras or, a civilian review board to saying, actually, no, we need to just reduce their scope and power. So this includes groups like the Advancement Project, Policy Link, even big foundations like the California Endowment. This also, we can see this with the ACLU nationally. They've said they're no longer in the police reform business for the most part. They want to get police out of the mental health business, out of schools. And I've been doing a bunch of events with ACLU chapters around the country who are trying to do this organizing, turning people out to budget hearings, to redirect resources that have gone to policing and jails and put them into, meaningful community services.
And you talk about the purpose of police, and maybe to fill this in a bit, you talk about, you've now said what the purpose of the police is not, and it's not to, I think you say, uphold inequalities, but you do talk about sort of the issues of inequalities from the get-go in our society. Could maybe fill us in on that end of it?
Right. So we typically operate under this sort of liberal understanding that police are here to enforce the law and that the neutral and professional enforcement of the law is automatically beneficial to everyone. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, the police have never really neutrally and impartially enforced the law. What they do is they enforce a notion of order, and that order is always the order of folks who have the most sort of political and economic power in our society. And the law is just one expression of that. And the law provides some guideposts for the police. But most of what police do is not directly about law enforcement. Most of what they do is not even related to crime in any technical sense of the word. Policing, in its origins, we can learn a lot from that. We can see that policing, which is mostly created in the first half of the 19th century, emerges in relationship to specific regimes of exploitation, to manage the consequences of that exploitation. And what we're talking about here, again, in that early 19th century, is things like slavery and colonialism and the molding of a new industrial economy. And so policing gets created as a more efficient and legitimate form of state power to put a lid on the resistance to and consequences of those regimes of exploitation, to prevent slave revolts, to prevent colonial uprisings, to stop workers' movements, and also to manage the crime and disorder that naturally emerges out of poverty, racism, and exploitation directed over sustained periods of time towards people. So if we understand that policing exists to facilitate that exploitation, then that helps us see through superficial reforms designed to merely restore trust in policing or help police better obtain public legitimacy. That instead what we should be addressing is the ways in which policing is continues to be used to facilitate broad regimes of exploitation. And so we need to begin to address those regimes of exploitation instead.
It will sound for some people, you know, I'm an immigrant, so that sounds exactly what the police does in our countries where corruption is playing out in the open. And it's a very hard information to swallow to learn that that's exactly the same way it's used the police in this country, where supposedly we have certain values that will protect people and allow them to develop and grow and find happiness and many other, you know, wealth and so on. But it seems that it's not the case at all. So this type of policing is widely found in the world, no? It's not only a product of the United States.
Absolutely. I mean, the origins of these things about the origins of policing are true globally. I mean, if we look at like the foundation of the London Metropolitan Police in 1829, they were developed out of models of colonial management of Ireland, quite directly. The specific people who develop colonial policing in Ireland then bring it to London to manage this massive influx of agricultural workers into London as a result of displacement, you know, from enclosures, et cetera, and form them into a stable working class for the new industrial economy. We can see this with the formation of colonial police forces in India and Kenya, you know, around the world. So this is a global phenomenon. I just wanted to say that, you know, in Mexico, what we see, especially in the northern part of the country, right, is almost a failed state where there's a kind of, you know, where the drug cartels have corrupted local governments, have bought out local police forces. And so there, the exploitation is like super evident in front of us. In the U.S., the police, you know, it's not that no one benefits from this notion of order that the police are maintaining. There are a lot of people who benefit from it, including some poor people in some direct ways. But indirectly, by suppressing movements and also by micromanaging the social problems that are produced by, you know, a neoliberal austerity politics, things like mass homelessness and black markets and stuff, it allows the continual transfer of wealth from the poor to the extremely rich. And so a community might benefit from some reduction in street crime, but they are still being subjected to predatory mortgages, stolen wages, predatory lending practices, discrimination and housing policy, right? So all that stuff, which has a much more harmful effect on the community than street crime, is allowed to continue by keeping a lid on the street crime, right? Wage theft in the United States is worth about 4 times all property crime combined. But there's no enforcement of that. That is not considered a police problem because it does not threaten the social order. It is the social order.
We've read over the summer, it's amazing, summer's almost gone now, this COVID summer, that in Los Angeles, there have been more than a dozen police killings right in the midst of all this movement. And the killings seem to go on elsewhere as well. So there's kind of two questions here. Some people say, well, the police just don't get it. They're not paying attention. Or I wonder what your thought would that be. And secondly, we've noticed that in Los Angeles and in the Bay Area, but especially in Los Angeles most recently, many of the victims seem to have Hispanic surnames. We haven't heard too much about that. But is that an issue that you've noticed, come across on your travels and your connections?
So let me take the last question first. So police kill all kinds of people. I mean, the majority of people killed by police are white. And the group that is most disproportionately killed by police are not black people. It's indigenous people. Indigenous communities by far bear the deepest burden of heavy-handed, aggressive, and murderous policing. So police abuse and police killing is just fairly distributed across all communities. Not fairly. It is distributed across all communities, but some have more of an impact than others. And African-American, indigenous, and Latino communities, all much more so than white communities. But it is not only a black problem, and it never has been. Remind me the first question again.
I was wondering if we were right in noting that over the past summer that in LA, the killings.
Yeah, right. Sorry. The police impunity that continues. Yeah. So the police remain unreformed, unrepentant, and unconcerned about their public image. And I think this just, if we weren't convinced before about the pointlessness of most of the procedural police reforms that have been debated over the last several years, the police this summer should have disabused us of any of these naive ideas that if we could just have another police community meeting and some anti-bias training, that would fix this problem. When our political leaders tell the police to wage a war on drugs and a war on crime and a war on gangs and a war on terror and a war on immigrants, and, you know, there will be violence, it will be racially discriminatory, and it will be unjust. And so this idea that somehow we can make the police friendlier and more accountable, this is public relations designed to distract us from the profound inequalities and injustices at the heart of American society right now, and the role that police play in propping that system up. And so, yes, the violence continues because that is what's at the heart of this system. And we're not going to fix this with more money for community policing.
Right. And it seems sometimes, as you are explaining to us, that the police is trying to keep this order, but they are already wired and they come to be a group of people that have certain values that are so engraved on what they do that they don't really see their neighbor. You know, one of the things that were discussed during the demonstrations in Poland it was that they were sending police or the sorry, I'm forgetting the name of the
U.S. Marshals and
the Marshals, yeah, the National Guard. And people were very concerned because they were saying, well, they don't know us. They don't know the population. But I was there wondering how that makes really any difference whatsoever if what you're wearing, your uniform, represents a behavior or a way that you treat your neighbors. Quite definite and violent, unfortunately.
I mean, the only difference would be that, you know, the Trump administration has a slightly different vision of what order is than, let's say, the mayor and city council in Portland. So then the policing will look slightly different. But police are violence workers. And the way they create their version of order is through violence. And that inherently affects the culture of the institution. Violence workers will always develop an insular and defensive culture because they are at war with the public, and they know that there are segments of the public that resent them. And so they will close ranks, they will become insular, and also they will come to see those that they are at war with as the enemy. They will dehumanize them, disrespect them, because they're charged with brutalizing and mistreating them on a daily basis. So this idea that we can change the culture of policing by giving them de-escalation training and having sit-down meetings with the community and teaching them about the history of racism is ludicrous and incredibly naive and fundamentally misunderstands the nature of the institution that they're dealing with.
Right. It's quite remarkable, in my point of view, that many communities feel that they need to keep on doing this, replicating this model. We live in a rural area, and the sheriff goes to many meetings, and we don't seem to have the same violence, but we are dealing exactly with the same issues of homelessness. And one of the biggest one, naturally, is the issue of mental health. So how the communities can really engage in a deeper change? Because naturally, we see that this is crossing transversally every community and every government, from the local government, state, and naturally federal government.
You know, when communities are told that they have one tool available to address their community problems, and it's police, then people will struggle to try to reduce the problematic impact of policing. And that's the dynamic that we're caught in, right? Is that for decades, people have been told you can have police or you can have nothing. And so people will say, well, I'll take police, but can you make them nicer? And what I'm trying to say is that that bargain doesn't work because you can't make them nicer. And that's what we've seen, right? The growing awareness, frustration, and anger over that reality. And so it's time to quit accepting that false choice of police or nothing, when we could actually be demanding, why don't we have high-quality rural medical care? Why don't we have infrastructure projects that can put people to work as we phase out of, you know, carbon-intensive extractive industries? Why don't we have a real, you know, agricultural development project? Why don't we have real drug legalization that could allow the open cultivation of drugs in a kind of reasonable regulatory framework that might actually create stable formal employment for people in rural areas? Right, none of that's being talked about. Instead, people are told police are nothing.
Well, we need to pause here to have a radio ID. We are today with Alex Vitali. He is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College, and this is Talking About California. I am Loreto Rojas. I'm here today with Carl Winslow talking about the issue with the police, and particularly, we are celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month with these conversations. So the issue also of the Latinos is quite prevalent. We have this topic you were referring about trust. And this is a topic that has been discussed a lot lately. We call it la confianza in Spanish, right?
Entiendo. So,
muy bien, gracias. And So Latinos also are, this is the one of the biggest thing, and I know you talk about this, that when we live in a marginalized communities, often in the outskirts of cities, because the system has created all this, including housing and where we live and where we can move around. So since we cannot really trust the police, and this is not only prevalent for brown people, but particularly we see all the killings with the African Americans, we are left to this sort of no welcoming the police in our communities, how that really affects the community at large? What are the effects of this lack of order? Or, well, I guess we have our place, so there is this precarious, safe place, or not?
Well, so, you know, there's not one Latino community in California, right? There are folks who've been around for generations. There are folks who are undocumented. There are folks who, you know, are business owners and others who are day laborers. So they experience policing in different ways. And some of them come out differently on the political spectrum about these questions because some of them benefit from a vision of order that involves the tight micromanagement and criminalization of newer arrivals. Now, one of the sections of my book, The End of Policing, is on border policing. And I argue that border policing has never really been about keeping people out. It's been about two things. It's been about the creation of whiteness, right, by othering certain groups and privileging others in racialized terms, beginning with the Chinese Exclusion Act in the mid-19th century. But it's also a system of labor management. Border policing is a system of labor management. There's never been zero immigration, and there never will be, right? We have thousands of miles of border. There's no possible way to close the border. Trump's wall and all this is just symbolic theater. What he's trying to do is establish a new labor regime that places undocumented migrants in an even more desperate and degraded circumstance. But when we had more open borders, I grew up in Texas in the 70s when there was a great deal of two-way movement across the border, there were still undocumented folks were denied full legal rights. This was used to suppress farm workers' movements, to engage in wage theft in the service economy against a population that couldn't complain. And farm owners and service industry owners were very happy to have undocumented workers for precisely this reason, their lack of ability to complain, their lack of ability to organize, to enforce their rights. So we need to, and now we're in this situation where the border is everywhere. So that ICE is in the cities, it's in the rural areas, it's in the middle of the country, and that creates insecurity for undocumented people everywhere, which again degrades their ability to organize, degrades their ability to create stable lives for themselves, and strengthens the hands of employers to exploit those populations. And police are a part of that process.
It just seems like it's not a very good labor system, since especially here in California, it's so obvious that so much of the work being done is being done by immigrants. Is there a difference, do you think, fundamentally, I suppose, between Trump, who's been going back, first of all, with the gang members in Staten Island, or not Staten Island, in Long Island. And the killings in, I think it was San Francisco, murders, rapists, and so forth, and then shifting over to blacks and the cities and so forth. Is he just desperately searching for issues, or how do you have any thoughts about his plan here?
I think that's exactly right. Trump is feeling political pressure. He's in trouble, and so he's falling back on certain kinds of tropes, certain political approaches that have worked in the past. So he's upping the racist rhetoric at campaign events, talking about, you know, what good genetic stock his all-white audience is, you know. And he's trying to mobilize this fear of crime, tough on crime rhetoric, you know, mano dura, right? And so he's trying to demonize gangs. He's got Operation Relentless Pursuit and Operation Legend, where they're flooding cities with more federal law enforcement and more money for local police to get the drug cartels and the gang bangers, you know, and these super predators that Trump is creating rhetorically to gin up white fear in hopes of, you know, getting people to rally around him. What's interesting is that it's not working, and deeply encouraging is that his support among whites is actually declining, and that this tough on crime rhetoric isn't getting any traction, because the analysis about the ways in which this is a racist trope that's disconnected from reality has really taken hold, because of the street protests, because of the organizing that's been going on for years now. So I think we'll see Trump continue to try to pursue this tough on crime strategy. And my hope is that people will continue to reject it.
The movements, the demonstrations, and I think probably, maybe especially in New York, have been large and noticeably multicultural, more so than in the past. What about that and all this stuff about the millennials and the youngsters today?
Yeah, well, something's going on, right? We're in a political moment, and I think this is a continuation of a variety of things. I mean, we can see this beginning with the protests against the killing of Trayvon Martin, but also with the emergence of Occupy Wall Street and the rise of Democratic Socialists of America and the growing number of insurgent politicians who are getting elected in local elections around the country, whether it's city council or even in some of these contested Democratic primaries for Congress. So there's a convergence here, right, of folks who have moved beyond a kind of liberal analysis of, you know, working within the system for at best incremental reforms, to a much deeper analysis that understands that racial exploitation has always been at the heart of the American political and economic project, that we have deep and worsening economic inequality, and that the planet is dying. And I see increasingly these things coming together and people acting in solidarity. So we see climate activists out protesting police brutality, and we see Black Lives Matter activists supporting, you know, Democratic Socialist candidates on a Green New Deal and economic inequality and labor rights agenda, right? So there, it's a very exciting moment to see this convergence of a deeper, more progressive analysis.
Yeah, the changes are that are needed are quite profound and meaningful. I ask myself how that can be done under these circumstances, with this president in charge now, even talking about the way he's talking about elections as well, how elections are going to happen. The topic of the violence of the police, it seems to be permeated everywhere of the society. And what are the My specific question would be, what are the changes in the police in making new laws to change this? How the community, I know you mentioned already participating in local governments and such, but how do you foresee a deeper change?
Well, I think, you know, the defund the police movement is not in and of itself this deeper change. But I think it was Huey P. Newton who said in the 1960s, you know, as part of the Black Panthers, look, we have to feed ourselves. We have to have some basic security in our lives so that we can continue the struggle. So they set up breakfast programs and health clinics and things like that. And the defund movement is sort of like that early stage of like, we need the police to quit killing us. And also we need mental health services and better schools and stable housing. And then hopefully out of that, we can build political power for the more substantial changes, to deal with macroeconomic policies, to deal with environmental destruction, to deal with, you know, structural racism built into banking systems and housing, you know, markets and employment markets and things like that. So that's, I think we're still at that stage one of fighting for subsistence, for survival for a lot of people. And hopefully out of that will come, and we're seeing more of this deeper analysis emerging out of that, solidarities. And I think also an awareness that to get what we really want, this has to be done on a cross-racial basis. You know, no one group is going to be able to solve this problem on their own.
And there's been a lot of discussion about, well, we need to, and this seems to always come up, rightly so, I guess, that we need to talk about racism. But sometimes, and it seems like it's happening here, that the issue of the police sort of gets a bit lost in the discussion of individual white racism. I don't know, is that something that happens in other places? Or because it seems like there was Ferguson, but there wasn't really a movement that was prepared, really, I thought, for George Floyd and what followed.
So we have to be careful here, because there is a tendency to want to talk about racism in interpersonal terms. So at work, we have to go to these anti-bias trainings, mm-hmm, that are paid for by the boss, and that structure the conversation about racism in terms of what the employees are doing to each other, rather than really thinking about the way in which the institution that's paying for the training is reproducing racism both within the institution and in the larger society. Because why would the boss pay for a racism training that implicates the boss? So that everything gets talked about in terms of these microaggressions. The way you looked at me at the water cooler, and what you said at the lunch break, and the joke that you made that was not funny and I felt was offensive, right? And yes, that stuff exists, and yes, people should quit doing that stuff. But when we focus on that to the exclusion of all else, right, then we ignore all these structural factors, the way, you know, banking is organized, the way housing markets are organized, the way labor markets are organized, the way government spending is organized. And we can't really do anything about deep historical and contemporary racial inequality unless we are operating at that bigger level as well. So what sometimes happens, right, is we get caught up in finger pointing about you're a racist, and then we lose track of these institutional factors. So that then we, you know, does it really matter whether we uncover which police officers are racist when the whole project is racist? Mm-hmm. Right? So that's what we have to be careful about. Obviously, we, you know, overt racism by police officers can cause them to be worse than other officers. But the war on drugs is a racist project, and it always has been. And it does not matter what the race or racial attitude of the individual officers who carry it out is. It is still a racist project.
So it's not working either, this idea to include, like in our town, they talk about including Latinos in different boards and places of decision. And some of us Latinos have been inundated with requests to help the whites to understand our situation. Do you have any words of wisdom about that? It's quite interesting that many well-meaning people, they seem not to have any tools to deal with this larger situation.
I think we have to demand that they become allies in these fights for structural change. So the Latino community undoubtedly has grievances and demands that go to structural forces, the way the cities and counties, you know, distribute resources, access to healthcare, access to affordable housing. And I think we just have to say to folks, if you're actually concerned about racial inequality, quit worrying about the kind of jokes you tell and how you look at people on the street and start getting involved in a fight for real justice. And hopefully out of that encounter, out of making a good faith effort to do that, some of that interpersonal stuff will show improvement because they're actually dealing with human beings in a shared human struggle. And I just think these anti-bias trainings are so hopelessly ineffective because they've been completely depoliticized, and it's something that's imposed on people. And I just think that we learn racial acceptance, tolerance. What we really need are to be race traitors, to give up our white privilege and stuff. And that's not just about, you know, how we look at how we speak to people in a meeting. It's got to be being part of a shared struggle for some real vision of a deeper notion of justice.
This is, very, very interesting, Alex, and thank you. And I hope I'm not asking you to be repetitive, but I'm thinking about some questions that we missed in the earlier part of the interview, and because we didn't mention what sometimes is termed as the militarization of the police, which I think is an important concept. Now, is that new and it's just more so today again? Or is it something, it doesn't seem like it's something that we've always had. And the second thing, which is I think maybe worth commenting on, is the role of the police unions. And there actually have been, it seems to me, quite properly under the spotlight recently.
So police militarization is not new per se. I mean, it's looked differently in different times, but the history of policing, like the history of prisons, is a history of reform, but that reform has often led to making the police more in line with kind of militaristic models that have been at the fore at a particular time period. So there was a whole round of police reform about 120 years ago. And the people who shaped that round of police reform to make them less corrupt and more professional were people who'd had experience in military policing in the Spanish-American War and World War I. And then another round of reforms happens after World War II by people who were military police officials in World War II. More reforms out of the 60s that was influenced by what was going on in Vietnam. And at the same time, police have been influencing U.S. foreign policy. So it's a two-way interchange. I recommend my friend Stuart Schrader's book, Badges Without Borders, that talks about this long history. And also my friend Julian Goh at the University of Chicago writes about this. So militarism is not just about the hardware. It's also about the mission, the training, the intelligence gathering. It's a lot of stuff you don't see. And again, when we tell the police to wage all these wars on the public, it's going to be suffused with this kind of military mindset. But it's not one thing, and it changes over time because the military changes how they do things too. They try to win heart and minds. They do counterinsurgency. They do, you know, nuclear weapons, you know, mutual assured destruction. So there's a lot of things that count as militarism. Police unions. Police unions are, they're a focal point for resistance, but police unions have never just represented the police. Police unions also represent conservative homeowners associations and real estate interests and merchants groups, right? Because they're the ones who are manufacturing this notion of order that they want police to enforce. So they people say, well, why are they so powerful? They don't represent that many people, but they always represent right-wing social forces more broadly. So there's no simple solution to that, except that we should do everything we can to limit their political power. And I think the way to do that is to associate the unions with the terrible politics that they support, and to make that as toxic as possible for politicians who accept their endorsements and contributions, et cetera. So we have to say to elected officials and candidates, look, if you're taking union money and endorsements from the police, you cannot be our friend anymore. We cannot work with you. We cannot support you. That this is disqualifying. You're canceled. I'm okay with that. Because what those unions stand for is so diametrically opposed to any kind of real progressive politics. You know, those unions are never just saying, well, we also want 2% on our pension, or we also want, you know, this healthcare package. No, they want mass criminalization. They want a culture of impunity for themselves, right? They want mass incarceration. They want more tools of violence. And they want to see the world through a lens that defines social problems as being the result of individual and group moral failure that will only respond to punitive and coercive and violent interventions. And that worldview is diametrically opposed to any kind of progressive politics that's rooted in trying to build people up, to create stable communities through investment and services and more basic equity. So we have to break their power by driving a wedge between them and the politicians who claim to be our friends.
And, you know, Seattle, apparently they've chucked them out of the AFL-CIO. Is that...
That's fine. I'm all for that. I don't think they should be part of our labor movement. I mean, I'm not in the business of breaking unions. I'm a fourth generation unionist. I just think that's not a good strategy. It will be used against us by anti-union forces. So if they form associations, and some of them aren't even formal unions to begin with, they're going to form associations, but we have to neutralize their political power by getting them out of our labor federations and distancing them from elected officials.
Yes, at the end of the day, as you were saying at the beginning of the interview, they are just the armed forced that is perpetuating these huge social disparities that we find ourselves in it. One of the things that calls my attention is that even here in our little county, the public health director is using the word, he's saying that we are on a war against the pandemic. Right? So it's all this terminology that goes to permeate, it feels sometimes to me, every single social issue that we are dealing, including the pandemic with COVID-19. Can you refer to this language that moves, you know, it creates again this idea that the inner or in a small circle, we have the enemy that we need to, and we don't know what is it. So how that actually perpetuates, how continues this idea of separating, and some people that are for sure bad and the other ones that we are suffering for their influence.
Yeah, this is this kind of Manichaean thin blue line worldview, right? That says that there are the good people and there are the bad people, and the police are in between them, trying to wipe out the bad people for the good people, right? And this leads to all kinds of horrible abuse. We look at like gang suppression units and gun interdiction units and narcotics units that violate people's rights and commit acts of brutality because they're at war with people. And it's that same simplistic us versus them mindset that leads to all this war discourse. And in this case, the virus is in human beings. So are we at war with those human beings who've been infected with the virus? Are we going to just start wiping those people out? Does this lead to some kind of eugenics type approach, right? And of course, they want to send the police to enforce, right, public health measures. This is completely misguided. All the research shows this will not work, that this will be counterproductive. And that's what we've seen. It's just led to more police abuse and less compliance. This is not a policing issue. This is not a war that we're fighting. This is a public health challenge. That means we need to invest in people's public health.
Well, another, I keep skipping from one thing to another, but there's so many issues. This is really, really good, Alex. But now, what about the appearance of the sort of vigilante types and their apparent cozy relation with the police? Is that something new? And I suppose it fits in with something which is not, I don't know if you want to comment on or not, but the prospect of some kind of a fascist movement developing, including the police.
So this is not new. The history of sort of political policing, the policing of movements, has always been apolitically biased, because again, right, this notion of order that police are preserving is a politically right-wing order. But the other, and as part of that, what we've seen historically is that political policing has always worked hand in hand with other right-wing forces. So the Red Scares, the Palmer Raids, going back 100 years, were always done in conjunction with, you know, Catholic leagues and anti-communist groups who would collect intelligence, who would take blacklists and intimidate employers, get people fired, you know, would break up meetings. So there's nothing new in this. It is deeply threatening and should be exposed. And it's just one more reason why we should demand that police not be used as a tool for solving what are ultimately political problems. Mm.
Seems like we have a long way to go to actually overcome these issues and stop all these killings that are happening. So we are almost at the end. We just have another few minutes before the end of the program. But we know that you also are teaching, and I wanted to ask you how that's going on for you, and what do you see your students saying about this issue?
Yeah, yes, I am teaching at Brooklyn College. I'm also watching my own children going to school online primarily, and the challenges that come with that. It is a difficult learning and teaching environment for everyone. I have deep respect and sympathy for K through 12 teachers trying to manage in these extremely difficult times, and for the parents of kids who are dealing with online education. My students at Brooklyn College are mostly non-white, recent immigrants or children of immigrants who, you know, the median income is for a family at Brooklyn College is about $30,000 a year. So these are first-generation college kids, and they feel very acutely the social problems that our society has been producing, the threats of homelessness and economic insecurity and lack of health care and all that. And they bear much of the brunt of heavy-handed policing. And they're really, and they also see the contradictions of our economy, of our lack of a decent health care system, and the challenges to the environment. So I think they feel this very acutely, and it can be very depressing for them. And I think one of the challenges is to give students some kinds of access to visions of possible ways to move forward. And I'm a big believer in a positive aspirational politics, not just a negative accusatory one.
You mentioned Texas a couple of times. You know, Southern California has changed so much. in my lifetime. Do you think there's hope for Texas with the demographic changes that are taking place?
Yes, I do. I think that we are going to see some changes in Texas. I think we've seen signs of that already in the recent Senate, you know, race that happened there. And I think the demographic realities are going to settle in. The Republicans were aware of that, and that's why they tried running a bunch of Latino candidates 4 years ago for president, in hopes that they could win over enough of the Latino vote that they wouldn't need to be the all-white party. But Trump has really undermined that with his white supremacist politics, and the fact that so many Republicans have just fallen in line behind him. It's really possible that they've created long-term harm for the party by alienating non-white voters, possibly for the next generation.
Let's hope that that change will come to many other places in our country. This has been so very interesting, Alex. You are so emphatic in the way you speak. So I really want to thank you for coming and joining us this afternoon. This is interesting, important, and very generous of you to share with us. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Gracias.
Gracias a usted.
So this is Cal Winslow with Loretta Rojas, and we've been talking about California with our guest, Brooklyn College Professor Alex Vitale of the City University of New York.
And please join us next week. That will be the first Tuesday in October at 3 p.m. Our guest that day will be Professor Maria Rendon. She's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine, and she's the author of Stagnant Dreamers, How the Inner City Shapes the Integration of Second Generation Latinos. Thank you very much. This is Casey Wayak. Good afternoon.